this week's episode of Unfiltered, I headed over to Tivoli Brewing Company, the place where this whole thing actually started, and talked to Dr. Ethan Tai, who is running their brewing operations now, as well as Steph Raymond, who is the GM and Director of Marketing, and Ken Heyer, who's been on the show before. He's the CEO of Tivoli. Wonderful conversation with three great friends. We hope you'll enjoy it. We covered a lot of ground and talked, you know, what they've been doing over the last 6 months and then expectations for what's to come as these winter months come. So hope you'll enjoy it. Hope you learned something and hope you're having a wonderful week.
This episode is brought to you by Elon Naturals. Handcrafted in Boulder, Colorado, Elon's all-natural products are made with CBD extracted from Colorado-certified hemp. Ryan and Alec Nyberg, good friends of ours, founders and co-owners of Elon, as well as big supporters of craft beer, including being supporters at the Sip Beer Fest we did earlier this year, use no toxins, no chemicals, and only certified organic ingredients in everything that they make. Whether you're looking for bath bombs, foot soaks, lip balms, pain sticks, or tinctures, Elon has you covered. And they make pet products, too. Find Elon Naturals on Instagram and Facebook and place your order now at elonnaturals.com. When you do, plug in the promo code UNFILTERED20 at checkout for 20% off your order. Again, that's UNFILTERED20. Plug it in at checkout at elonnaturals.com for 20% off your order. This episode is also brought to you by RoofTech Precision Exteriors. Founded by a fourth-generation roofing expert and two veteran general contractors, RoofTech combines unmatched residential and commercial roofing knowledge with project management excellence, which means your next roofing project will not only be handled by those that know what they're doing, but know how to complete your project without wasting your time. Find RoofTech on Instagram and Facebook and learn more at RoofTechCo.com. That's RoofTechCo.com. And when you schedule your roof replacement project, mention Unfiltered and receive a free upgrade to impact-resistant Class 4 shingles. I have no idea what that means, but it sounds like it's a hell of a deal. Again, that's RoofTechCo.com.
Since he started.
Yeah.
It actually legitimately has been. Mostly the weather. I think I might have sad.
It happens.
Yeah.
So, Dr. Ethan Tai, sorry.
I mean, that's fine. You don't have to say the doctor part. Saying the doctor part makes me feel like my dad.
Ethan Tai, PhD.
That's not the industry we're in anymore.
Next up, your name, friend.
Stephanie Raymond, friend.
And what is your title?
And I'm the general manager of Tap House and the director of marketing.
And you've been here for how long?
Over 5 years.
Over 5 years.
I'm the oldest.
Yeah, you are. You were here before this old gray fox.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
And I've seen him get grayer in the last 2 years. It's crazy.
And he's so tan because he's been in California.
I've been golfing.
You've been golfing. And your name, sir, friend of the pod.
Ken here.
And your title?
This week it's CEO.
Okay. What was it last week?
CEO.
CEO, okay. And next week, who knows? Cheers. To you three, by the way. No, I am so happy to be here. Let's just talk shop right away, Steph Raymond. I'm gonna turn it to you. Give me the timeline for when you opened back up, and what have you seen in the week since?
Yeah, we reopened on June 1st, so a couple days after Governor Polis announced that bars and restaurants could trek back into the waters, and. You know, we were fortunate enough that we had applied for our patio extension early enough. We were the first of three venues to have that granted, so it's been nice having that extra safe outdoor seating for us, best view of downtown. But it's been a slow gain, to be fairly candid on it. Mm-hmm. You know, not having live classes on campus, people very timid on venturing out still. Outside of even just neighborhood bars, I think has really put a damp on downtown Denver in general. And, you know, not having sports has also been a really big hurdle we've had to overcome. So it's helped having some classes come back to campus. We saw a really good pickup the first week, August 17th.
Okay.
And then a really quick drop off the following 2 weeks. So, I mean, the snow doesn't help this early in the year, but we are where we are, so we're just trying to make subtle gains each day.
So, obviously, folks know MSU Denver, but what are the other schools doing down here in terms of return to classes? Is it the same approach where it's, you know, very minimal classrooms being open?
Yeah, I think all the leadership for the three schools have been adamant in communicating. Even if you're on campus or have hybrid courses where you could come to campus, they're really pushing for you to not come to campus. Yeah.
That helps a lot.
Yeah, sure. Safety first, I'm all for that. But I feel that at some point we have to get on living our lives safely. You know, COVID's not going to go anywhere anytime soon.
Right.
So
are
why
you
not give faith to operators who are doing everything they possibly can to be smart about operations?
Right. I've asked Ken this because we played golf together and I got a very candid answer, but now I would like to hear your candid answer. Are you getting many shitheads coming in that you're having to fight with about masks and spaces and all of that stuff? Or is everybody kind of following the rules?
Yeah, you know, we haven't had major altercations by any means. When we first reopened, everybody had to adjust, you know. There were maybe one out of every four or five people didn't bring a mask, so we gave them, you know, just a surgical cloth one. Now more and more people, they have their own masks. You just have to remind them, you know, get up from your table, even to leave, just put it on. And we haven't had anybody have major discrepancies with that. People get it. Luckily, we're in Colorado and not in Florida. So
yeah, people
are fortunate.
I think people go over that hump in the first month.
Yeah. Okay,
that's any problems we had were generally early.
How much of it do you think is location, being downtown as well, versus, you know, being, let's say, down south a little bit? Because talking to brewers down there and brewery owners, you know, you get a little bit more pushback in certain areas. Do you think that's playing a part in it, Ken?
It could be, but, you know, it's an individual thing. And really for us, it's protecting our license.
Yeah.
We can't have people walk in without a mask because we have to go by the guidelines or our license is at risk. Mm-hmm. So that means everyone's livelihood's at risk if we don't clamp down and say, these are the rules, and if you don't adhere to them, then I'm sorry, you can't come in.
Is this something you had thought about as CEO as you began to open back up, as making sure that you weren't one of these hot spots, you know, in June, July, and August? Because I would assume as a restaurant, you know, that is something you have to worry about. A brewery, a place where people congregate.
I mean, totally. I think we took the guidelines we were given and we added to them. I mean, we were ultra careful. Just the cleaning regime, Steph and her team have done a phenomenal job on, I mean, the sanitary conditions. I mean, ultimately, your guest has to feel safe.
Yeah.
And they have to feel comfortable. Then they'll come back.
Yeah.
And we've had multiple new guests come back and say, we came back because this is a really safe place to go.
Yeah.
You're, you know, the hygiene, the sanitation, the ability to sit outside, you know, there's shade out there. People feel very comfortable. And I think at the moment, people would rather sit outside than inside.
Yeah.
Obviously, in a day like today, with snow and everything else, you know, we can seat 152 people in here. We're allowed 50. Mm-hmm. So the benefit of that is people can spread out.
Go ahead.
So I'm saying we can provide a safe indoor environment too, but we have to cap it at 50 right now.
What do you have to do in the back as, you know, kind of heading up the charge of brewing in terms of COVID-specific safety and spacing? Has anything changed, or just because of the nature of, you know, beer making, those kind of protocols are always in place?
I mean, for the most part, in addition to the usual stuff that got imposed with COVID. So every day, temperature checks, physical wellness checks. Whenever the brewers are out and about, we have to mask up as well.
Okay.
In the back, we are, for the most part, because we have to run under sanitary conditions, we're usually either gloved up or we're just dousing ourselves in Sani solution, right?
Yeah.
Like Alpeed. Alpit D2 is what we use to basically disinfect, or I guess you could say sanitize, any surface that we're working with. So, I mean, we're just constantly sanitizing everything anyways. As far as being socially distant, for the most part, the vast majority of the day,
mm-hmm.
you know, we're in completely disparate locations in the brewery. It's not like we're crowded around. Frankly speaking, you can't really have more than two people on the brew deck anyways, mm-hmm. and each person is manning some other part of the brew deck. You're going to be 6 feet away from each other. So that's not really too much of a concern. And considering some of the breweries that I've visited, mm-hmm. it's basically the same thing.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. On a brew deck, you can't fit a ton of people on there. Two people maximum, really, and you're almost automatically, just by nature of what you have to do on the brew deck, you're going to be socially distant. Otherwise, yeah, brewers that are wandering around potentially face outward facing, you're masked up. When you're inside the brewery and people are having to stand, you know, within 6 feet but not right next to each other, you're still, those people are going to mask up.
And it's a safe space, you know, it has to be a safe space to even begin with. And I think that's the same thing with the restaurant industry, you know, it's,
I think that's one of the things that lends itself reasonably well, you know, either in the restaurant industry, in the brewing industry. Mm-hmm. The conditions have to be incredibly sanitary to begin with, right? You have to have, you know, significant sanitation. Mm-hmm. You know, in the brewery, we've discussed it before, you know, in a separate podcast, that you basically are making a place for microbial fauna of any kind to just basically have a party, and you're just hoping that it's just yeast, right? So you can imagine that in order for you to
Fingers crossed.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that means then that the level of cleanliness that you have to abide by already, the level of sanitation you have to abide by already in a brewery is already, should be, theoretically.
So think incredible. Of a different way. The whole world has now come to brewery standards, or should be.
Yeah, or should be, right? Or even, you know, the food industry standards, yeah. right? It's the basic shit. You know, I was talking to my wife the other day. This, you would think, and I think
you're still talking to her.
Yeah, the two oldest are back in school, so we're good. We haven't been this good in you know, months. But I think you and I were talking about this when we were last saw each other. Is there's a good chance that people wear masks now into perpetuity when you're sick, and we never really thought about, you kind of just should anyway. Right? Just wear a fucking mask. But I'm guessing that just becomes a social norm. So maybe that's a good thing. Yeah. I wanted to ask you two. I know we talked about kind of foot traffic here, but you see downtown and you kind of look out the window all the time. What are you noticing just in terms of people?
There's not a lot. So what we've seen with our general market business coming back on the draft side is downtown's hurting. I mean, there's no conventions. Hotels aren't busy. There's no ball games. There's no sports. So really, the only people downtown are the limited number of people working downtown,
yeah.
you know, whether they're staying around for entertainment afterwards. Mm-hmm. Some people may drive downtown for dinner, but not many. Okay. So we've actually seen more business come back from neighborhoods and suburbs than we have from downtown on the draft side.
Why is So people are going, why is that? More space? More?
Or just they're going local because it's convenient and they've figured out there's a safe outdoor space or a safe indoor space.
Okay.
Rather than drive all the way downtown and they don't know what's going on down here.
Are you getting many students in here now that things have kind of...
No, I would say maybe one out of every 10 people is going to be a student or a staff or faculty member. We've actually had probably 85% more new or first-time customers in the last 30 days than we have returners.
Okay.
And again, that just goes to the communication that they're getting from their executives and leadership, so we can post about it and urge them as much as we want, but if they're only making the trek here maybe once a month, then they're parking for 2 hours and they're right out of here.
Are you getting much support from any of the universities? I know that's not their job, right? But any kind of cross promotion, that kind of, or there's not much that can be done?
Not so much cross-promotion. Certainly MSU Denver will promote people coming here for our Mug Club happy hours that we host virtually and live every third Thursday of the month. Auraria Higher Education has done some, you know, retweets and tried to promote their other vendors, including us. But really, it's it's kind of all up to all of us as vendors to be able to get people on campus.
Try your best.
The only thing I'd add to that is it's even tougher than normal because essentially this huge building we're in mm-hmm. has one open entrance, which is at the far end of the building from where we are.
Okay.
So our normal entrance people can't use. They have to come in through our patio.
Okay.
So it's almost makes it worse mm-hmm. that this building is closed for certain reasons, which isn't really solving the problem they were trying to solve.
Yeah.
But that's not helping either. So there's a lot of confused people walking around campus trying to figure out how do we get to Tivoli Brewing Company, and they're wandering around this huge building, and some of them just give up.
Yeah, that makes total sense.
Especially when it's either 100 degrees outside or 30 degrees outside.
Yeah, you give up real quick. Before we kind of move on to next steps and all of this, what kind of preparation did you have to provide for your staff as you started opening up? And feel free to chime in here, too. I mean, what I would assume it's a lot of safety, like rehashing safety standards and all of that. I mean,
that times 100, I would say. I came back to prep us reopening. So it was really sanitizing and disinfecting things. Getting all the materials we could from DenverGov and the health department specifically on what the guidelines were, making sure we had printed materials not only for our team but also for guests. Everybody that came back to start did so the first few because they couldn't get on unemployment. So we started off bringing people back very slowly and tried to prolong bringing as many people back as we could. Mm-hmm. But they all had to go through a training, like an hour training of what chemicals we use to sanitize, what chemicals we use to disinfect, cleaning the bathrooms every hour, not just restocking and wiping things down. You know, it's a lot more than that now. You're truly disinfecting mm-hmm. everything at least once an hour. You touch a glass, you have to wash your hands. So it was a tedious process. They've all gotten very good at it, and they picked it up quickly because, one, it's life and death, but it's also like this is your job, so you can either fall in line or good luck because nobody's hiring right now, and that's the other thing. You know, we had to urge people to possibly look for second or third jobs because when you don't have the volume like you used to, we're down probably 80%, I would say, at this point, in what we would normally do for tap house sales. So,
what were those conversations like? I assume really difficult.
They were candid. They're not easy, especially when you have students and they had just moved out from California, or this is like their only job. That's nothing you ever want to say to anybody. You try to give them all the tools you can, which is why we prolonged so many people from coming back, because we wanted them to try to collect as much of that government assistance as they could at that point, right?
Did you have any issues with any of that stuff, getting the small business loans and or, you know, the support? Everything was okay as a whole?
Yeah.
Well, we managed to get a PPP, which allowed us to, you know, look after the staff.
Yeah.
That was most of that money went to payroll.
Okay.
Which, you know, that helped us for a couple of months.
Okay. Sorry, Steph, I cut you off.
No, you're good.
How many folks were you able to keep on?
So right now I think in the tap house I have about 15 employees, including our kitchen team.
Okay.
But even some of the kitchen team chose not to come back. A lot of it was people either finding other jobs or opportunities or moving back to their home states. We're still losing a couple of people here and there. I can't say that it impacts us operationally, you know, and we're fully supportive of people needing to live.
Yeah.
You know, so we were able to bring back as many as we could.
Yeah.
We didn't have to deny anybody, which was the best part. That's probably the most positive thing about it.
Yeah.
Everybody was offered their position back. So.
So you're young in your career, not to pinpoint you, but you're not.
I'm glad we're not on video right now.
Is this the hardest thing that you've had to do as kind of a senior level leader of an organization? Like, not hardest thing you've had to do, but I would assume this has been one of the more challenging moments of your career.
I think it's got to be one of the most challenging 6 months of anyone's career.
Yeah.
No one's had to deal with this before. There's no... No one wrote the book on it. There's no guidelines to follow. No one's got a crystal ball.
Yeah.
So you just have to plan as far ahead as you can, but keep the immediate goals in focus, because you know you're working day to day, but you're also trying to make some longer term decisions, because day to day this doesn't work.
Yeah. Yeah. How has it impacted how you view the beer industry?
I mean, I think the beer industry is fairly resilient.
Okay.
The thing I'm most concerned about is the bar industry, the bar and restaurant industry, because that is the one that's really taking it. So whether it's a tap room like this, whether it's a fine dining restaurant, a hole in the wall, a neighborhood bar, they all have the challenge of how do you get a bunch of people into a tight space, having a good time and drinking beer again. It's until there's a effective vaccine and everyone's fully on board, that's not going to happen again. And even if it does, you know, some people are just not going to, you know, they found a new lifestyle, they've found a way of entertaining at home or drinking at home, or they've changed their behaviors because they've been forced to change their behaviors.
Is it a generational thing? Like, I mean, does this impact an entire generation?
I think it's
a half, you know,
it's like three generations.
Yeah.
It's people have changed their behavior, how they shop, how they purchase, how they entertain, where they get their, you know, their entertainment from, you know.
Yeah.
Someone who used to go out, eat out 2-3 times a week, what do? Did they go back to that?
Yeah.
Or they said, oh, well, we found a new way to do it. So who knows? I mean, especially if you think on in the especially with craft breweries, one of the reasons tap rooms did so well is that was a big pastime.
Yeah.
Hey, what are we doing Saturday? Hey, let's go hit 6 breweries. What are we doing Sunday? Let's go hit another 6. Yeah. What do we have to do to encourage that to come back? Because that was it's a cold, you know, rainy Sunday in Denver. What are we going to do? Yeah, let's go hit a bunch of breweries.
How does this impact your career now? Having just kind of, not saying you're just starting, but you know, we've talked about your future and what you want to do. So what have you learned over the last 7 months?
I think just to reiterate, you know, the consumer behaviors have been completely different. They've flipped upside down. So on the other part of my job with the marketing thing, we've learned consumers became way more interested in buying bread making machines. And
That's true.
It's up like 600%.
Is it over now? Is that craze over? Are we done?
I still can't buy
yeast, enough shitty bread.
You can't buy golf trolleys. Oh. You can't buy.
It's so true.
It's all the
fucking like weights. You can't buy free weights.
Free weights are our yoga mat. People would kill for them. You can't buy a bike.
You can't buy a bike for
can't buy under $1,000. No. It's only high end.
I know. It's crazy.
Yes.
So if you think of it purely to jump on what Steph was saying from a consumer behavior standpoint, there's no one that anyone could ever do to flick a switch that happened in the middle of March.
Yeah.
No one could ever come up with that. I mean, Amazon, Google, Apple, they couldn't invent something like that. They just flicked a switch and changed consumer behavior overnight.
Yeah.
And this thing did.
Just like that. I mean,
truly.
What do you have anything in particular that you think you've taken from this, maybe in terms of just food consumption, that is crazy, or how we're gonna, are we done going to restaurants? Are we doing to go orders into perpetuity?
I think we're looking more and more at the what's the term? Looking more and more at people watching how-to videos and bespoke content, right?
Yeah.
So, you want to make bread, that's great. Make some bread with Tivoli beer in it. I think that's the content that we're starting to look at. It's also, if we want to attract people here, making it more clear on the choices that they should be making with food and beer options, mm-hmm. and kind of forcing that sale, so to speak, versus just letting somebody come in and order a glass of water and wings, saying, no, like, you have to have it. This Mountain Squeeze Juicy IPA, you have to. So I think content on the marketing digital-wise has changed a lot. And then, yeah, we have to adjust and say people aren't necessarily feeling comfortable right now to come to tap houses, so how can they enjoy Tivoli beer at their homes? And again, that's the bespoke content, having Tiv in the wild and going on your camping trips with our beer. It's just kind of flipped dramatically.
How does this impact your job in terms of, I guess, in relation to packaging and, you know, knowing that we may not be drinking a ton of beer over the bar as much as we used to. And now we have to make sure that every beer that comes in that can matches a style. It has that Tivoli, you know, Hellas taste or you know, the Mountain Squeeze taste. How does that impact what you do now on a daily basis?
That's pretty difficult to answer. I mean, there are three main things really that encompass answering that. The first would be, I'm sure Ken and Steph can both seriously and I don't know, sarcastically or in jest, you know, talk about the level of neuroses that I have to just accept, right, and exhibit in terms of thinking about the beer that's being produced and how that has to be true to a specific flavor, brand, right? It's true to brand, TTB. And we have to hit that every single time. Consistency, you know, especially as with my prior background with the brewery and quality management, right? Consistency is key. But then that means then that the other two facets, I guess, of that answer, right? A neurosis that's driven by a need to make things consistent is one, right? Then there is the accompanying, you know, neurosis of I need to figure out how I can not only make the beer consistent, I need to now, because of how slim our margins are with the disappearance, essentially, of a large margin that draft gives you, I now have to start optimizing to the best of my ability the scarcity of resources. Mm-hmm. And it's a scarcity that's driven by a lot of different factors, right? COVID has essentially changed the global supply chain. It's impacted things in ways that we haven't seen. A good example of it is I needed to get, you know, acidulated malt, sour malts. We were delayed in being able to get sour malts from one of our German producers for up to 2 weeks because, firstly, they were having difficulty generating it, and then they had a difficulty getting it to us because you had import-export issues. You don't have, for example, people to man. You don't have people to work. Alternatively, you don't have the shipping lanes as free and available as you did before. You have a whole lot of inclement weather potentially. So, for example, in Houston, we had a problem where we had two hurricanes pass through South
Houston,
Texas.
We have a problem.
Just like that.
Well played.
I mean, it's. You know, you have all of these particular issues, right? So a neurosis for consistency and quality management. You now have a neurosis in optimization. And then there's the third thing, which for the most part is kind of on the back burner now, but is becoming more and more apparent now that you're seeing, especially, you know, we had mentioned prior, you know, the idea that Labor Day is a breaking point. And we certainly see now, you know, the non-trivial issues that we face when you look at people like Periodic, where they just are now officially gone, right? Chris and his gang are done. Surly, for a number of reasons, has decided to close their tap room and beer hall. That's done for now. Eddie Line, same story. They're done for now. New Glarus, same story. Done for now. And what that really speaks to is that when you looked at a place like Surly Brewing in Minneapolis, that was considered a destination brewery for that massive beer hall. When you look at Eddie Line, where there is a destination brewery in Buena Vista. When you look at New Glarus, which is a very storied upper Midwest brewery, it is considered for, if you want to get Spotted Cow, you have to make that pilgrimage. You no longer have the cachet anymore, right? To be considered a destination brewery. You can't have that gimmick anymore.
Wasn't that coming, though? You know, you and I have had these conversations plenty of times.
You knew that it was coming. It's just that, it's not that COVID caused this to happen.
It just accelerated it.
It accelerated it.
Yeah.
In a way that was absolutely, you know, unprecedented. We knew that the bubble had to burst at some point.
Yeah.
COVID just provided the really big needle to jab the balloon with.
Let me ask you then, and either any of you can chime in, but I know that, you know, he's looking at these contracts and the numbers every day. What does this do to hops farmers? To hop farmers?
I don't even want to talk about that. It is.
That's a bad subject with him. We've been digging out a hole. But
I mean, if you think long term, though.
It's bad.
So it's really bad. So where we were 3 years ago with scarcity of supply and everyone's getting into long-term contracts, the whole thing's been flipped on its head. There's now classic supply and demand has gone backwards and because of this.
Yeah.
So there's all these long-term contracts and there's no demand. So where there's lots of supply now. So hops going forward ain't going to be a problem in terms of supply.
Okay.
But in terms of long-term contracts and pricing and everything else, it's going to be...
When does that change, though? When do the farmers go, you know, it's just not worth it?
Well, they may convert some of their fields back to something else.
Yeah.
It's going to be really hard to say. Honestly, the word that I've been... So working with a lot of the hop brokers and dealers and talking to some of the farmers, you know, personally, the biggest challenge now... In hop growing in the time of Corona, it's difficult because you already had an exacerbated roadblock to certain levels of productivity because of climate change. This year, for example, the hop harvest was accelerated by a month.
Okay.
It shouldn't have been, but we saw because of climate change. You know, Yakima Valley suddenly was harvesting hops one full month earlier than it needed to. On the western slope or, you know, in the southern part of the state, again, in Colorado, in Idaho, the same thing was being experienced. Hops were being harvested a full month before anyone was prepared for it. Europe was starting to see some of the same effects. So now you have an issue where you now need to get people to harvest your hops. If you don't have a large industrialized, like a fleet of wolf pickers, you have to do that by hand. No one is going to want to stand around harvesting hops, you know, shoulder to shoulder trying to manually pick hops. That's just not going to happen. You don't have any more of these larger, seasonal workers that can come in to do that picking, to do that work.
Yeah.
Right? That's gone.
Because they're not issuing those visas.
Yeah.
Right. And then on top of that, you now have a situation where these people, you know, several people now are contracting very long. A lot of these hop farmers are needing people to contract long, but now you have complications to productivity. And so you have this incredibly volatile market where no one really knows what's going on. So you're basically hedging on futures, and no one likes to do that.
Yeah.
Right? Nobody wants to play that game of hedging on futures where you have a driver with a pandemic, you know, drivers of the pandemic, climate change, and you still have people that are trying to push forward the development of, like, the latest, greatest, sexiest hops, but who's going to buy them?
Let's get optimistic for a second, because I think we're going to go back to pessimism as we wrap up this show.
No, we're not.
How good was it? How opportune was it? How fortunate was it that you made this shift in terms of can designs when you did? That you found that brand when you did? That you just a clear aesthetic to everything you do.
We wouldn't be sitting here if we hadn't done that.
Yeah.
So call it good fortune. Call it, you know, foresight in the way the market was moving to cans. You know, some would say we were late to cans. In the grand scheme of things, I think we were right in the middle. You know, we've been in cans for 18, 20 months now. If we hadn't made that move, we wouldn't be here right now.
Yeah.
Cans is how we're surviving. Our can business is up on a great start last year. Last summer was phenomenal for us. Summer of 2020, we were up 60% on last year. Now, that's not enough to offset all the draft losses.
Yeah.
And that's not even factoring in the tap room.
Yeah.
But in the month of August, we were actually up 1% in wholesale than we were last year. So in the month of August, our can sales to the general market did make up for the draft loss by like 10 cases.
Yeah.
But hey, we're up 10 cases for the whole month.
You're up.
That's unbelievable.
You're up. I mean, director of marketing. So like knowing this, right? Kind of, I'm not saying seeing the writing on the wall, but not knowing what's going to happen over the next 6 months as it gets colder. What are you doing in terms of the Tivoli brand to keep it top of mind as we get into these colder months where I go into the liquor store and I want to get that can of you know, Tivoli beer?
Right now, I think just consistency is the key. You know, we have the brand identity has been established within the last 18 months, which is great. The fact that we've been able to receive compliments even from off-premise and in our distribution team on us always having fresh beer available and not running out of things is a huge thing we have to tout. But I also think, you know, having that brand awareness and communication, that's a really big key piece to the marketing objectives right now. So working with PR groups and certainly trying to drive people to the tap house, but also just you can take our beer anywhere, right? So yeah. The biggest piece of it right now is, yes, come in, come see us, we're alive, we're doing things safely, but also grab our beer anywhere. So that's going to be the biggest objective over the next 4 months in terms of digital communication. But consistency, I think, is probably the number one priority for us.
Yeah, I'd add to that by saying that we may not spend more money on marketing than we have been, but we'll put a lot more effort into it, because really that's going to be the key going forward. Mm-hmm. Is, you know, as you say about being optimistic, when we can sit around and look at each other and go, what the hell we're going to do? Mm-hmm. Or we can actually go and do something.
Yeah.
So the key is, let's get after it. Sometimes it's not just about, you know, dollars spent, it's about being clever, creative, and giving it that energy and actually going out and making stuff happen.
How important is it, you know, that you know, I guess Kyle goes in there and makes sure that, you know, the Tivoli boxes or the Tivoli, you know, Brewer's Choice or whatever, you know, that case is, looks good on the shelf, and those displays that you've been doing so much, it has to be kind of invaluable,
it's
right?
It's huge.
Yeah.
That's all part of it. And giving the not only our own sales team, but our distributor sales teams, giving them the tools to go sell, giving them the confidence to go sell our brand. They know it sells.
Okay.
So what difference that makes? They're going in selling case deals, displays, because they know it's going to move.
Okay.
They don't go in and sell something that, I secured that display, but I know it's going to be there next month. So it's that's the optimistic part of it. Again, it's down to consumer behavior. Mm-hmm. So what does the guy who used to go to the bar 5 nights a week.
Mm-hmm.
What's he doing? And how do you influence his choice?
Yeah.
How do you get that guy to drink your beer at home? Well, I think that's one of the keys.
So how do you do it?
I mean, you get it in front of him. Again,
yeah.
You get it in front of him.
Okay.
You, whether it's through his social media, you know, that he consumes.
Yeah.
You know, we're not going to put it on TV in a Broncos game.
Yeah.
That's just not our game. We don't have those budgets. We leave that to other people, my previous employers. So how do you get it in front of what he consumes, whether it's just from a PR standpoint, any of his social media channels? He walks into the store, he sees the display, he goes to the cooler.
Yeah,
it's there at eye level. It's multiple touch points, and all of a sudden, you know, it may take a while, but suddenly, you know, Mr. Joe Sixpack says, man, I really got to try that Tivoli. I'm seeing it everywhere.
The cans are just so good. They still are just so awesome. I mean, my God. hard seltzer. You going to can one? I was at Costco the other day, and I saw Upslope now sells slats of them. They make their own flats. I made fun of everybody a long time ago, but not anymore. Now it's so, that shit sells.
The problem is that if you look at the designation legally,
yeah,
right, for what we're allowed to call seltzer, right? You can basically make seltzer from a sugar base that's non-malt, and you can make seltzer from malt-based sugar, right? Those are the two divides that you've got.
And you could make it from spirits if you wanted to, but pay a different tax rate.
Right, right. Okay. I think at the end of the day, you have to ask yourself, if you're going to make seltzer, that is kind of that double-edged sword, mm-hmm. where you look at, if you're going to make seltzer, there is, without going into the vagaries of the process, that is a type of procedural, I guess you could say, move that is non-trivial, right? For the home brewer, it's easy to say, oh, add the sugar, add the water, add the yeast, let it do its thing, maybe add some flavor, let it carbonate, and you're done. When you start looking at it on a much grander scale, there's a reason why a lot of people that would theoretically or could theoretically make seltzer. It's the reason why if you make it with the pure sugar, there are some things you have to do. Mm-hmm. If you make it with the malt, you're actually way better off making the fruited malt beverage, right? FMBs.
Yeah.
You know, there's a reason why that divide suddenly shows up and why you call that the FMB, you don't call that a seltzer, because the expectation of the consumer is geared when you have an FMB, you simplify the process of the fermentation because you no longer have to worry about that from that standpoint.
Yeah. I look at it differently. I think you can look at it two ways when you're a brewer of our size. Do we want to be in that game, and do we want a tiny slice of a fairly significant pie now? If it's 10% in the market, you got a tiny slice of it, that it's volume. Mm-hmm. Do you want to get in the volume game? We want to sell some cases. So if you're wearing your business hat and you need to fill up your brewery and get in that game for how long, or develop a brand, or just have a commodity that has seltzer on the label, it really doesn't matter what the brand's called. If it says seltzer, someone's going to buy it.
Yeah.
Do we want to be in that game? Yeah. Or do you say, on the other side, really, is it true to brand? Is that what Tivoli does?
Yeah,
is that what a craft brewer does? Is that what the consumer expects?
I appreciate that, honestly.
We choose the latter.
Yeah.
Technically, we have the expertise here with the people. Maybe not the equipment. We can get the equipment. Mm-hmm. We could get in the seltzer game. That's not for us. It's not true to brand. It's not what Tivoli does.
And especially, I mean, at this time of year, which leads me to my next question, because this is not just a craft beer podcast, a craft spirit podcast, and knowing, again, to kind of ask you questions because of your career, what can we expect as alcohol consumers as we move into winter, right? You know, we can get pessimistic about craft beer, but I'm assuming we're going to go a little bit more, you know, hard liquor. We're going to have a little bit more, a few more mixed drinks. What happens in the fall?
I think we've been into hard liquor since March 16th.
I know. But I mean, are those trends going to, okay.
So it's funny I'm going to combine your last two questions, mm-hmm. and be controversial. If I'm a big liquor company, and I'm sitting on the sidelines and I'm looking at seltzer, even with the higher tax rate that they would have to, say if they did a vodka base or a gin base, mm-hmm. or some type of spirit base, that's taxed at a different level to a malt base.
Okay.
But with the pricing available in the seltzer sector, if I were a big liquor company, if I were Diageo, mm-hmm. you know, Pernod Ricard, any of the big guys,
right,
I'd be in that game in a heartbeat.
Okay.
And I would go true to brand, and I would go with the base that they're... So I would do a Jim Beam seltzer.
It's so much easier for them to make that pivot.
I would do a Sky Vodka.
Yes.
I would do a Tanqueray gin seltzer.
Yeah.
Because they already have the brand name.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to create, they have billion-dollar brands that they don't have to recreate. Yeah. They put that label on a seltzer, yeah, we pay more tax. We don't have to spend the marketing dollars on it because we have a brand. So I think that's next. I think the spirits guys are going to get into the seltzer business in a huge way.
Does that, okay, things just seem to be, they're going so slow and so fast at the same time right now. Is that a move that you want to make if you are one of those big brands right now, or do you wait till next summer where it gets hot again? I mean, does it matter?
If I'm running what, a tequila brand or a gin brand or I'm in it as soon as I can develop the product.
Yeah.
They'd be crazy not to. And then it goes back to, well, what was the consumer's perception of seltzer when it started? Most think people thought it was a vodka soda anyway.
Yeah, that's true.
So I'm surprised they haven't got in the game sooner. And it was the taxation level that put them off. But now I think there's enough margin there for them to make a ton of money.
It's worth it.
Especially with on-premise down so much. They didn't get into it before, probably because they wanted to protect their on-premise business where people drink vodka sodas or gin and tonics.
Yeah. Yeah.
If that business is half of what it was before, how are they going to make it up? So beer, craft beer, big beer, everyone beware. Spirits companies are coming, and they're going to come in through seltzer. My prediction.
We heard it here first. I know. Do you need to go? Because you're good.
A little bit. I mean, I have probably like 5 or 10 minutes.
Knowing the conversations that you have with people that come in here, right, knowing conversations that you all have, give us a synopsis, in your opinion, Steph, what happens to craft beer, not in Colorado, because I think talking to the Cannonball Creek guys last week, we clarified Colorado, because of weather, a little different. You know, you can kind of drink outside in February and be okay, right?
Yeah.
But craft beer across the country and tap houses that serve food across the country. What are you reading? What are you expecting as we kind of move into these north? You know, if you're a craft brewery in Pennsylvania, I mean, that's got to be shitting bricks right now.
I think I'm most concerned on, you know, we're trying to build consumer confidence, but I'm most concerned by things I'm seeing from consumers on social media, giving pushback to either their states or certainly. Can't say that there's a national mandate on any kind of safety regulation.
That's for sure. no, I think it's
hashtag excellent. He did it. He knew. But I would say it's kind of concerning to see consumers on social media pushing back on, well, why do we have to wear these masks if we're just standing up at our tables? Why do we have to do this? It's just kind of like, you know, maybe take a step back and have some humility and some respect for a business that's trying to just survive. We have to operate under these conditions just to keep our heads afloat.
Yeah.
So I think that's our biggest worry nationally is there's just, it's become so politicized right now on how you would think one of the safest industries in the country would normally operate outside of COVID conditions is now being scrutinized and under the microscope, even more so than we were before. So to have people pushing back and it being the operator's fault versus like the condition we're all under, you know, this is an uncontrollable condition. I'm just weary about it. And again, I think it has to do with a lot of leadership, be it state level, university level, national level. Just we need to give consumers confidence outside of just me as an operator.
Is the to-go market something that you can take advantage of here in the tap house?
Yeah, I mean, and we certainly do. You know, we're finally able to offer to-go for beers and always for food, but we were finally able to start offering to-go for beer products and we've certainly tried to capitalize and it's been a big help for us. It's not something we plan on stopping ever. We're just trying to figure out how to make it even more efficient for guests.
Yeah, it's still not a big part. I mean, it's a very small percentage.
Can you ramp it up? Do you want to ramp it up?
Really, the location doesn't lend itself to that. It's really about traffic.
Yeah.
It's hard to, you know, we're more of a destination than a walk by.
Yeah.
But hey, you got to adapt to, you know, looking on the more positive side. You have to adapt to, hey, here's the condition. And
have you had the conversations though with, you know, the folks who run the food and said, all right, let's, have you thought about revamping the menu? Not to say it's not good, but in finding that kind of niche.
Yeah, I mean, we took over our kitchen completely internally about a year ago.
Thank God.
We've had some transitions.
Food's good.
Food is good. Yeah. But I think we can capitalize on that a little bit more. You know, there's definitely opportunities to make things more crafty and fluid versus just having your standard pub food, which we do great at. But I think we have opportunities to really open that up and bring in, I spoke about the bespoke movements, right? And bringing in maybe local farmers and utilizing their products more versus just buying from a big distributor. Supply chain is a really big issue that we've even witnessed within our kitchen. So if we can help out local farmers and not have as many issues going through a big distributor, then that's something that we have been looking at.
That's smart. That's really smart. I know you got to run, so I'm going to ask you, what do you expect the future of the brewing industry over the next 6 months? You can be technical, you can be...
I don't know, I think that...
Not too long-winded, though. I'll cut you off.
Yeah, I think that we're just going to see another repeat, right? We already said this is going to be a bust cycle. We're going to see consolidation. We're going to see a lot of people exit the industry. We're going to see consolidation like we saw in the, you know, late 80s, early 90s. But at the same time, I think that those smaller breweries that can provide a reliable supply of liquid asset, you know, if we as a brewery, as Tivoli Brewing Company, if we're able to maintain a supply of fresh beer consistently, increase production as necessary, and continue to expand, right, our production capability, that's just half of the equation.
Mm-hmm.
The other half is going to be like any other brewery that wants to claw, you know, out of this hole and claim market share. We already knew in Colorado it was cutthroat.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't enough, right? You had, most places were gimmick breweries because you needed the gimmick to survive. Mm-hmm. If your beer wasn't, you know, out damn standing, then you would just default to the gimmick, right? You would always default to the gimmick. Now there's no gimmick that gets people out. Mm-hmm. There is no gimmick that will get people
out.
That's
a good point. That's a good point.
Your beer now has to be so significantly better than your competition in whatever that market segment that you're going to be in. It has to be that good because no one is going to buy your product in a can if they see your can and they see another one next to it and their immediate choice is, I'll get the other one. I know that one's good. Right? No one will take that risk unless you have that reputation and have that brand image of this is going to be really good. You want to buy this. So you're going to have all sorts of small breweries that are going to be working overtime to produce and to try to find, you know, that beer style or that formula that will give them success by virtue of being that good. And that's going to be really hard, right? It's going to be hard for everybody, but for those breweries that are capable of devoting that time or are able to invest resources to have that type of capacity on both fronts, then those are the ones that will be successful, for sure.
Is this, I don't want to say the end, but does this take a big cut into a Weldworks? Because I do kind of agree with what he's saying in the sense that I think that a Tivoli lager has poised y'all to be able to weather this thing. Just because, again, marketing, right? I'm willing to pay a little extra to get that over a Coors just because I know where it comes from. I can't imagine, right, if I'm going to drink a hazy IPA, why don't I just buy a 12-pack of fucking Sierra Nevada?
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting. You can think of it from a brewery and style perspective, or you can think of about the type of brewery it comes from. So if you think where we were 12 months ago, you know, brew pubs are doing well. Brew pub model is a great model. A lot of breweries that were struggling were brew pubs that had then expanded and put packaging lines in and bottle lines.
Mm-hmm. You're good. See ya.
So, ironically, this has flipped it. So now the brewpub model is not looking so clever because I can't get people in my door. I don't have enough space.
Yeah.
If I have a patio or an outdoor space or a covered space, I'm still a great model. The guys that stretched themselves and put packaging lines in and went into distribution, maybe they'll survive. So ultimately now I think for most craft brewers, and I'm not talking about the big guys, but most small to mid-sized brewers, their survival prospects are really dependent on what percentage of your business is in package in the market, not how big's my tap room, what's my revenue streams, all that stuff. Ironically, it's now how many cans or bottles do I sell in the market, which that's flipped things completely. So maybe there's a lot of brew pubs are struggling because they didn't make that big leap, because that was an easy model.
There seems to be a a size. It's not the brew pub that's going to succeed, at least in my opinion. It's the nano brewery that'll be just fine. Like we were at Lady Justice a couple weeks ago. They're going to be fine just because of the size of it, and it's a tiny little spot. And
it's about location, and it's about how many people they can put in there. Or talking to Karen up at Holidaily, they're more than making up for lack of people in their tap room by their to-go sales.
Yeah,
their to-go sales more than make up for that. Roof. So, you know, but again, they have a high percentage of their product and package to the market. Yeah. So they're, you know, if you were relying on half your business being your tap room, that's kind of tough. If you're 80% tap room, you're in real tough shape.
Any closing comments, or should we have a cheers and finish our beers off air?
No, I think we're, who knows what the next 6 months will bring. I'm more worried about the next 2 months.
Yeah.
Looking more short to medium term, in that a lot of people make their money in the summer, and Labor Day is the great divide. After Labor Day, it's like, okay, let's look at the numbers are going to survive the winter. That's where the cull is going to come. Most people thought it was going to come before the summer, but everyone's optimistic and, hey, we're going to get through the summer and we're going to be fine. I think it's going to be a real tough fall. Never mind winter. The fall, September, October is the tough time. So we just have to, you know, plow through, keep surviving, and do what we can.
Steph, Raymond, Kinhire, two of my very, very good friends. I really, really mean that. I appreciate you both so much. Thank you for coming on the show. Ethan's gone, but cheers, and continue to make good beer, because I love this place.
That's all we can do.
So happy you came.
Can't wait to get back in my office in fall 2021.